From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We learn to compete when we're very young, when we roughhouse with our parents, grab that toy from our sibling, run for class president. As we get older, there are other competitions for that top job, that book contract, the money to start a company. Some people seem wired to win. You can almost see their nostrils flare as the going gets tough. Others seemed wired to flinch. Why the difference? This hour On Point, we look at the science of winning and losing. You can join the conversation. Do you get pumped up when the stakes are high or become a shrinking violet? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now are co-authors of the new book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. From San Francisco, California is Poe Bronson. Welcome, Poe. Nice to have you.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
And from NPR West in Culver City, California is Ashley Merriman. Welcome to you, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having us.
They were co-authors of the best-selling book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. But this new book, Top Dog, so interesting, so much to get to this hour. Let me start with one of the first stories you share in the book, Poe and Ashley, when you compare skydiving to ballroom dancing. And you find that an experienced ballroom dancer has the same level of stress before a competition as someone making his second or third jump out of an airplane. How can that possibly be, Poe?
Well, it's because it's not the dancing that's making them stressful. It's being judged. It's being watched. It's being concerned to make sure that the line of the leg meets the specifications for that dance. It's the feeling that you're up against other people, competing against them in front of judges, and that this means a lot to them. And in that sense, they parachuting while skydiving towards Earth at 120 miles an hour is risking your life, you're not really being judged. And you're not competing against anybody else. And the fact that competing is that stressful, not just for novices, not just for amateurs, but for people who've been doing it for years. In the ballroom dancers, they separated dancers who had only been doing it more recently, those who had been doing it, you know, for 5 years, and those who'd been doing it for like 10 years. And they found that those who'd been doing it for 10 years, those who had the proverbial 10,000 hours of practice, 10 years of experience, were still just as stressed out as the amateurs.
Well, that's an interesting point, Ashley, because what about that element of practice? Because you remember, you know, the book by Amy Chua, her, you know, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom, she talked about that the way to win is to practice, to work, to go through the grind until you leave nothing up to chance. I mean, you think about, oh, I don't know, Malcolm Gladwell and his 10,000-hour rule, which says, you know, you got to practice, you got to master a skill, and that's how you succeed. What about this endless hours of practice that makes you a top competitor? Is that true?
Well, we're not saying the practice is unimportant, but people don't get judged by how well they practiced. I mean, you can have a pianist who does a flawless concerto in the practice room. It's how he does on stage that everybody cares about. And in truth, yes, 10,000 hours, 10 years of practice probably makes you a very talented, proficient performer. But who gets 10 years of practice before they're expected to perform, right? I mean, little kids are on stage on recitals a couple weeks into the lessons. We're still demanded to do our best way before we actually have what we might consider an ideal amount of expertise. And also, at a certain point, you know, a PhD in economics is trying to get a job against another PhD in economics. They both have 10 years of experience. What's the difference? What separates one from getting that job and the other being told, sorry, maybe we'll try you next year?
So that's what you looked at in your book, The Biology of Competition. So let me set this up a little bit by describing what you call and what's called in the book, the COMT gene. You write that there are a couple of different enzymes affiliated with this particular gene, one that you call the hardworking gene and the other, which you say is a little lazier, a little more slow working. Warriors on the one hand and worriers on the other. Tell me the difference, Poe.
So those who in a normal population have the warrior genes have fast-clearing enzymes in the prefrontal cortex of their brain. And the result is that it's always lowering their dopamine levels in the prefrontal cortex. So on a normal day-to-day basis, they actually are below optimal level. And their brains don't work as well as they do. They actually need stress. Stress raises the level of dopamine. They need the stress to perform their best. Those who have the worrier genes, who have a slow, lazy enzyme, it doesn't clear the dopamine out as fast. But that's good on a normal day-to-day basis. On a normal day-to-day basis, their brains are at optimal dopamine level. And so they actually have a 10-point IQ cognitive advantage as long as they're not being stressed. It's when they're stressed that the dopamine floods the brain, those lazy enzymes can't clear it all away. And it's much like flooding a car's engine with gasoline. Their brain function starts to melt down. Mm. So you get kind of two types of people, just those who need stress, those who need not to be stressed. But just to be clear, both genes are equally dispersed in our population. Half of all of the listening audience would have one of each gene, and so they would have in their front of their brain both types of enzymes, and they would be somewhere in the middle.
So, Ashley, can a worrier learn to perform then in high-stress situations?
Well, you know, you can't change your gene, right? You're still going to have the worrier gene. But yes, absolutely. Quinn Kennedy, a researcher at Stanford, had an experiment where she took pilots of different levels of expertise. So the recreational pilot, who had just had a few hours under their belt and not that much experience, and she put them in a flight simulator. And she found that the worriers were overwhelmed by all of the tasks that were being asked of them. You know, the plane is rattling, the ice is on the wings. And the worriers were doing the best. All of those different things happening didn't throw them. However, with more experience, the natural advantages in working memory and planning and organizing come back for the experienced warrior pilot, so that those with higher ratings actually were doing better than the warriors. And one of my more favorite quirks, I think, in terms of the warriors are not doomed, is that researchers have actually found that Navy SEALs can be warrior gene warriors. So it's absolutely about training and context. In another unfamiliar setting, the warrior might suddenly be overwhelmed by the stress, but they can learn to adapt to particular kinds of stress with that practice and with that experience.
Poe, is there a gender difference when it comes to worriers and warriors?
Yeah, there is actually. So the COMP gene is upregulated and downregulated by a variety of things, and one of those is estrogen. So women whose estrogen levels increase twice a month, when that in that period of time, it basically slows down the COMP enzyme. And so if a woman is already a worrier gene person at those twice that time, twice during a month, it's like a double hit, Adele Diamond says. That it's already, well, one quarter is fast to start with, and then goes down another 30%. So they could be particularly more vulnerable to high stress moments. Again, as Ashley said, if it's an unfamiliar circumstance. If it's a familiar circumstance, something they spend a lot of time in, then they tend to be able to manage this. So this could be one of a variety of different factors that could explain some possible gender differences between men and women in their competitive styles.
Somewhat applies to the question that I have next, which is, when is it an advantage to be a warrior, and when is it an advantage to be a worrier, Ashley?
Well, I think, you know, Poe keeps talking about how we'd probably want a worrier Secretary of State, right? Worriers are good at planning and forecasting and thinking what are the likelihood things are going to happen, and they remember details and are good to sort of have that long-term strategy development. Whereas the warriors are probably good on short-term deadlines, more crisis managers. In fact, we've actually talked to a lot of people who said, oh, I think I'm a warrior. And they were indeed crisis management communicators and firefighters and people who sort of thrived on this kind of periods of calm and then just huge explosions of activity and pressure.
Mm. Poe, would you add to that?
Yeah, I think it's important when people hear warrior and worrier, automatically the question is, oh, can a warrior turn into a warrior? And one shouldn't jump so fast into not recognizing the strength of being a warrior. The warrior gene is equally distributed in our population for a reason. The warrior gene is one we share with primates, so it's been in our gene pool forever. The warrior gene was a mutation that is now very popular. It's half of all the genes out there for a reason. It increases the executive function, the working memory, the ability to plan and think ahead. And so optimize your environment, but don't worry about being a warrior.
Well, we're talking about top dogs and the science behind winning and losing. You hear the music. We'll go out on Danger Zone, sung by Kenny Loggins from the 1986 film Top Gun. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the science of winning and losing, and you can join the conversation. Do you notice differences in how men and women approach competition? Do you sometimes look at a very ambitious person and wonder if he or she is wired differently than you are? We're speaking with award-winning authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. They are co-authors of the new book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. So we've talked about worriers and warriors. I want to move on to this study in your book that got a lot of us talking around here. It measures the length of your ring finger relative to the index finger. And you talk about how people with longer ring fingers, genetically, biologically, are made differently. They have more of a competitive edge. Tell us about that, Poe. Why?
So, listeners, as long as you're not driving, you would want to put your palm, straighten your fingers on your right hand with the palm facing you, and you're looking at not your middle finger, you're looking at your index finger and your ring finger to see which one's longer. And those who have longer ring fingers, what lengthens the fingers, it happens when we're about 2 months into fetal gestation, developing in our mother's womb, and exposure to prenatal hormones changes the length of those fingers. At the same time, exposure to those hormones is affecting cell migration in the developing limbic brain. And the hypothalamus, the starting point of the entire neuroendocrine cascade response that we have to challenge, that hypothalamus gets wired slightly differently. So as a result, finger length is a biomarker for brain subtle, not exactly clear brain differences. And the result is that if people are looking at their ring finger, to have a longer ring finger is to make you more likely to be a risk taker, more aggressive in response to challenge. It's associated some with spatial ability, with entrepreneurism, with going into risky careers. So there's a scholar from Northwestern University who studies University of Chicago MBAs, and she looks at what career they go into, whether they go into a high-risk career like high-tech and high-finance, or they go into a safe career like a fortune, a regular corporate-type job somewhere in the Midwest. And she can predict pretty much very well what kind of career people are going to go into based on their finger length and a little bit of a saliva ratios. Same thing predicts whether in Italy, a study of 3,000 entrepreneurs predicted the size of the company and the growth rate of the company off that thing. No, there is a male pattern. About two-thirds of men are going to have a longer ring finger, and one-third of women are going to have a longer ring finger. So this has an association with gender, but it may actually really transcend gender.
Ashley, I'm reading here from your book, research has also connected ring finger ratio to success in competitive sports, such as soccer and skiing, correct?
Right, and also London financial traders. So there's a variety of different, you know, it's a proxy then for a number of things that sort of fire, you know, require you to be maybe fired up. And one of the theories, as Poe has mentioned, is that early initial prenatal exposure to testosterone may change the way your body responds to testosterone in the moment. So we all, you know, if you're in an exciting thing and you have a challenge ahead of you, you can get an increase in testosterone in your bloodstream. This is true for men and women. And it pushes you forward in a competition. And that early prenatal response to testosterone may then make you more susceptible. So perhaps that testosterone in a moment is sort of like super testosterone for those with those long ring fingers.
But does it automatically then disadvantage women having less testosterone generally?
No. I mean, on average, women probably have 1/5 to 1/7 the amount of testosterone that men do. But a high testosterone woman is going to be reacting very similarly to the high testosterone male pattern. It's not that women have low testosterone, so they're less motivated, less passionate. That's not the case at all.
Let me move on.
Yeah, I want to jump in there.
Please,
Poe. Make clear that we're not talking about baseline testosterone here. We're talking about the body's testosterone response. The body increases the level of testosterone in the 24 hours before a big challenge.
I see.
And women and men both get that increase. We also, based on individual differences, foretold by the ring finger, have a different rate of responsiveness to that testosterone increase. Mm. But women get that, even if they're starting with lower baseline levels, they still get that increase just like men do.
Mm. Let me ask you about gender and competition. In the book, you write that boys and girls excel in very different environments. You say boys, from the studies that you've read, suffer academically when they're in a very competitive environment and they're not at the top of the heap, whereas girls perform better in those kinds of environments. Poe, why is that true?
And this is research from Great Britain, from Trinidad and Tobago, from charter schools in the American South, and from studies of students at Chinese universities. And what it seems to be is that in a highly competitive environment, if you're always comparing yourselves to others, and you're not coming out favorably in that comparison, that can really wear you down. A healthy competitive skills, which we want everybody to have, includes the ability to sort of turn off that relentless self-comparison, to turn down the feelings of competitiveness. And it seems that girls in these sort of hothouse elite schools are better able to do that. They're also better able to ask for help and get help. And uniformly, girls in highly competitive schools tend to do well. Boys, it's not that they're not doing well. It's that they would often do better in a less competitive environment if they're not coming out on top in those types of things. We tell the story of the U.S. Air Force Academy, tried to socially engineer in this experiment. They didn't tell the incoming freshmen that they were doing this, but by arranging the squadrons, they were trying to get those who might be low performers and have them sort of spend all day long in these squadrons with really high performing, academically bright, especially bright students, hoping that the bright ones would rub off on the other ones and lift them up. Mm-hmm. But the opposite happened. By these low performers felt terrible being compared all day and sitting next to these really high performers, and it made them more self-conscious of how they were doing. And as a result, their GPAs went down, not up, from being around us. So I'm not saying take your kids out of highly competitive schools, especially the boys. What we're trying to say is it's important to teach the skill of turning down that relentless self-comparison all the time.
What is that skill, Ashley? How do you do that?
Well, I think one of the things to note, especially in the studies of girls and boys, is that boys tend to be a bit overconfident. They expect that they'll do well even at a new task, whereas girls actually expect that they might struggle and their opponents, their classmates, will probably start out doing better than they will. And that kind of a perspective may really have an effect in those hothouse schools, right? Because the boys who expected themselves to do really well are suddenly surprised and demoralized by the fact that they're not the ones on top. Whereas the girls didn't expect to be on the top to begin with, so they're not so threatened by this. The Air Force cadets, even the low-performing Air Force cadets, are some of the best students in the nation, right? They've been recommended by their congressmen to go be leaders of our military. So they're not expecting to be struggling, and it's a surprise and a shock. So one of the things we need to do is have people understand, whether it's young children or you're going for a job interview, thinking about your capabilities and, you know, and being confident, but not to the point that you're overestimating how well you're going to do compared to everyone else, in a point that it may start tripping you up. If you're feeling that this confidence is motivating you to succeed and work harder, then that's great. But if you're feeling so overconfident that you're taking your success for granted, that's where the problems begin.
You also write that boys and girls have very different relationships with each other, and that this affects how they compete later in life, that boys tend to hang out in groups, girls more in twosomes. And when you're in a twosome, Poe, I guess you're less likely to want to outdo your friend. Is that the thesis?
Well, yeah, this is work from Joyce Benenson at Harvard and Emmanuel College there in Boston. Fascinating stuff. This is probably some of our most interesting research that we uncovered. By the time boys and girls are 2 or 3 years old and in preschool and then given free play time, boys will be spending 2/3 of that time in group play. Girls will be spending only 1/3 of that time in group play and 2/3 of it, or about 2/3 of it, in pair-based play. And in pair-based play, whether it's boys or girls, but it tends to be more girls, differences are thrown out of the relationship. People don't discuss differences because they threaten the relationship. They discuss the things that they share that are equal. In pairs, people take turns. And in pairs, people self-deprecate. They don't want to show that they're stronger than the other person because that threatens the relationship. And in all these ways, pair-based play builds habits that people take with them, Joyce Benenson believes, throughout the rest of their life, even when they're not in pairs later in life. And the boy-girl difference there actually increases. So by the time they're 5 and 6 years old, boys will be spending like 78% of their free time in group play, and girls will be spending only 16% of their time in group play. And so there's a big socialization effect in addition to the biological effects that are shaping people's individual competitive profiles.
Ashley, I want to get in this story about, well, the idea of how you motivate people to success. The large national office furniture chain deciding to test if letting their employees know that their national sales rankings would motivate them. Turns out it didn't work at all. Tell us that story.
Right. Well, they had had sort of the local chain, you know, that individual store, they would have rankings. And even if it wasn't something posted, people sort of knew that Joe was better than the rest of us, or I'm, you know, third or fourth or whatever. But this national furniture chain decided to start publishing national rankings of where every one of the salesmen and saleswomen were on their sort of leaderboard. And they expected this to increase competitiveness. And what happened is that the sales of the entire chain dropped over 20%. And they looked further. Researchers analyzed this, and they actually found that almost all of the drop happened from the men. That they found, finding that, you know, you were first or second in your actual local store was great for your motivation, but finding out you were 300th in the nation was really demoralizing.
But for the women, it was different.
Well, the women, there really wasn't any effect at all. And I think that goes again to the sort of where women are expecting their opponents to be doing as well or better than them. And they just weren't thrown by the idea that they were, you know, 300 or 500 in the nation. They just said, okay, whatever, and kept going. One of my favorite studies was actually an accidental natural experiment in Basque, Spain. They had a new computer program that was just going to generate report cards for the students. And one of the principals at the school just sort of randomly checked a bunch of boxes of new stuff that would come on kids' report cards. Never, didn't really think anything out of it. And the report cards lit a firestorm of response. Because one of the new pieces of information in the report card was how your kid was doing compared to the average kid in each class. And the students and the teachers and the parents said that the kids are becoming more competitive and they're becoming more concerned. And immediately they took this box off of the report cards as soon as they could. But researchers several years later said, huh, did it actually help their grades? And it turned out it did. Having that ranking was there, but it was crucial. It wasn't how far your kids are from the best students. It was how far they were from the average. And the students who were the best looked and said, hey, if that's the average, I can do way better than that. What we've learned is the most important thing about competition and motivation is that it has to be a close race. You have to feel that you have a fighting chance, that you can make that move. The furniture salesmen who were depressed and frustrated over their rankings, they didn't think they could move up enough. They started giving up. That was also going on with those hothouse schools and the kids and the Air Force Academy. You need to believe, it's not that winning is ordained. You can't take it for granted, but you do have to believe it's in your grasp.
It's so fascinating. We have so many people who want to join. I've got to get one in before the break here. Let's go to Lebanon, Tennessee. Haywood is on the line. Haywood, I'm sorry to rush you here, but if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. Thank you for calling.
Yes, ma'am. There was a study, and it was on y'all's radio station back several years ago, about students who were high achievers in high school, captains of the football team, baseball team, and stuff, who then later on did not amount to a hill of beans, and yet the mediocre and the reserve students went on to be corporate presidents and really overachieve. And, yeah. You know, and she was talking about some of these learned things. I'm an ex-military officer. I'm an ex-combat helicopter pilot, and we were taught not to get excited, not to lose our cool in the line of fire, and those that did that survived. And our West Point cadets who were gung-ho, nine out of ten of those ended up in some type of terrible accident or gunfight.
All right, Haywood, thank you for the call. Poe, would you respond?
Yeah, sure. As Ashley has been saying, overconfidence or, you know, a too easy track record, those who have not learned to lose would be another way to describe it. Those captains of the football team and the basketball team, those who've never had losing in their background may not know how to respond to challenge when they do lose. And it's important for our kids from the youngest ages to have losing experiences that they, you know, come back and play the next week and lose at card games and board games and tiny youth 5-year-old soccer games, and to learn that losing is not so risky, not such a big deal, so that when you do face challenge, you learn to come back from it. As to the military situation, military people deal with enormous stress, and those who can manage that stress response are definitely those. The scholars are absolutely looking at this in a military context, too.
Well, we're discussing how our biology affects how we compete with the authors of the new book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Here we are in the Eye of the Tiger from the hit film Rocky III. We'll be back with much more of this interesting conversation and your calls after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the science, the biology of winning and losing, and you can join the conversation, listeners. Employers, how do you get your employees to perform at their best? Parents, how do you instill a healthy sense of competition in your children? We're speaking to award-winning authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, co-authors of the new fascinating book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe and Ashley, I've got callers lined up around the block here. Thank you all for waiting. Let's go to Carol in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carol. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I was wondering if the research included anything about age changing, whether you are more likely to worry or do battle. I used to work in local TV news, and we didn't have very many reporters who were over 40, 50 years old, or photographers for that matter. Part of it, I know, is a physical thing, but if you suddenly wake up one day and you don't want to battle anymore, which is what happened to me, can that be a function of age?
Got it, Carol. Thank you very much. Poe Bronson.
So, healthy competitive skills, as we've said, includes the ability to kind of turn it off and doesn't matter. It also means that you're not going to fight every fight. You're going to focus on ones that matter to you. And what the science seems to be saying is not that as people age, they can't respond to challenge. It's that they pick and choose their battles more. They effectively conserve their energy for when it really counts. And it can be your motivation on a daily basis can be that you look at one little news story and say, you know, that's not the most important story in the world, and you don't get up for it because you've seen a lot of different stories. While someone who's younger, maybe it doesn't conserve their energy as much, and they're like someone who can sort of pick a fight anywhere, anytime. They sort of see the challenge in everything and they respond to it. So you could see that there could be some age differences there. But by and large, once it matters to somebody, no matter what age they are, they can absolutely respond with challenge. Mm. And the hormones that transcend age.
Hmm. To Jamestown, New York, Rose is on the line. Hi, Rose. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a comment about children and school-age children especially.
Okay.
I feel personally that competition is used way too much in school to get children to do better and to, get good grades and so forth. I think that ends up becoming a dysfunctional thing because it's used too much. Too many kids don't feel good about themselves because they are competing against, everyone else in their class.
Rose, thank you. Ashley, would you respond?
Well, I think there's a problem in schools right now in that the competition is sort of never ending. And what we're talking about is really from trying to get into the right preschool to the day you graduate high school, it's all about one thing is going to permanently screw up your permanent record and everything is over, and that the stakes feel really high. And one of the things that's important to understand is that we need ebbs and flows in competition. You need to have a moment where you're excited and you're feeling engaged in something, and then you've got to recuperate. And I think that we don't have that much time for kids to recuperate. So we've been talking to researchers about should there be more competition or less competition in schools. And the researchers say there should be more, but it's not the constant. We have to be the best every day. That's that thing that gets you worn down to where you give up. It's more like spelling bees, science fairs, so that kids understand I'm going to be preparing for a particular moment, and then I have my shining moment. I don't even need to win, right? There's no expectation everyone is going to win a spelling bee. You're just somebody isn't. Hmm. But you can learn the words, you can have fun practicing, and then you relax. And you wait, and then, there'll be a debate or an audition for a drama class the next time. So it's that ebbs and flows that seem to be more motivating than just this constant overwhelming high.
Poe, I was reading your book, actually, when I was hearing on the news Melissa Mayer at Yahoo telling folks at Yahoo that they would no longer need to work from home, that they have to come into the office now. Given your research, will that help Yahoo become more competitive? Do people work better when they're together exchanging ideas?
Well, she knows the environment specifically there. What the science says, science definitely, one of the seminal studies was this one of IBM telecommuters, which said that they actually are more productive working from home than coming to the office. And there's a lot of different variables there, including the fact that there's team-based work, and team-based work slows people down in their efficiencies. But, some types of people need monitoring and some types don't. introverts do not necessarily need that type of monitoring. Extroverts need the attention, need the extra extra activity of being monitored, being around each other. What she seems to be saying is not just that telecommuting is the answer. What she seems to be saying is the problem is her employees are acting like this is a mature company. She feels like they're not really giving it their all. It's an experiment to see if this is going to work, but she does feel like they're not trying as hard. They're not acting like a young internet startup anymore.
Ashley, in the book, you say that competition actually helps creativity. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. Well, there is, I think, a concern that, you know, real artists aren't competitive, right? They're sort of beyond that, and they're just all them and their muses. But the research says that's absolutely untrue. In fact, historically, many of the innovations that you rely on every day were actually driven by competitions. The fact that we've canned and bottled food is because Napoleon sponsored a competition how to better feed his troops. And competition is about an exchange of ideas. So you may think, gee, I want to be creative. But it's when you have a competition, when you have a deadline, when you have someone else who's trying to do something at the same time, that's when it sort of kicks up and heightens your response. And what's fascinating is that what it takes to be a great competitor are the same traits that it takes to be a true innovator. You need the ability to problem solve on the fly. You need to withstand challenge and conflict and not be thrown in the face of opposition or criticism. You need what the psychologists call agency. And agency is the belief that you can set a course for yourself and follow through with it, and that you trust your own opinions as to whether something's right or wrong. People who don't have agency, those are the guys who are looking over their shoulders saying, is this okay? Should I do this? And those are the people who are going to be struggling in a competitive environment and struggling in a creative environment.
Back to the phones. Su Yen is in New Rochelle, New York. Hi, Su Yen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I have two boys, and I can see that they are hardwired, one for the warrior gene and one for the worrier gene. Simple things like in the morning, my youngest will be at me from 7:45 to get to school on time. And my eldest will be dilly-dallying and 20 minutes later realizes that he's running late for school. So clearly, they live in the same house, same parents, same exposure, and yet very, very different approaches to life.
And are they
very
competitive with each other, Su Yen?
Do you know, not really. Competitive internally more so than with one another. My youngest will work night and day to ace a test. My eldest, the night before is good enough.
Su Yen, I'm so glad that you called. It leads me to part of your book, Poe and Ashley, where you write about siblings and their comfortability with competition. It's a little different than what Su Yen was talking about, but important nonetheless in terms of your research. Poe, would you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I grew up with an older brother and a younger brother, and so this definitely resonated with me. But siblings are fighting and competing all the time over the remote control, the video devices, parental affection, food, whose leg is crossing some invisible line in the back seat of the car. They argue 3.5 times every hour. 10 minutes of every hour they spend together is spent arguing, and they get used to the aroused emotions, the jealousies, the envies, the compromises of competing, and they tend to have more competitive skills that come out of this because they're more used to doing this when they have to get outside the home and do that same thing, go up against other people. Probably most surprising to me was that those who've been a youngest sibling, so you're looking at oldest siblings versus others, those who've been a youngest sibling, they have experience day-to-day in their home with standing up to someone who's bigger, stronger, who can take what they want and wants to crush them all the time. And when they get outside the home and they're into a competitive environment, be it in school or in sports or in their hobbies, they're less traumatized, less confused by the same situation when they're not the best. And they're more prepared for the continued work ethic that it takes over time. So Su Yen was saying she has a younger child here who has a tremendous work ethic. And that could be one of many factors that's explaining why.
What about, Ashley, this notion of positive thinking? You know, actually imagining yourself taking that victory lap or giving that great presentation. You talk in your book that actually maybe that makes you less likely to succeed. How so?
Right. Well, part of the necessary things for succeeding is to have that motivation, right? We were talking earlier about testosterone, responding in the anticipation of a challenge. And if you're thinking, wow, this is going to be easy, this is a cakewalk, then you may not have the mental or even physiological preparation to really stick that challenge through because you've sort of taken it for granted. And there are studies of, you know, Olympic tryouts, and the gymnasts who walked around saying, wow, I'm going to be great when I'm on the Olympics, they didn't make the team. It was the athletes who struggled and would chide themselves on the mistake and then move on. Those are the ones who became Olympians. And what the researchers have found, I love work by Gabriella Ontingen at New York University, where she had young children who were in Germany learning to speak English. And she asked them, what could be the most wonderful outcome of learning English? And, you know, some of them just went, well, my dad would be proud of me. But some were saying, oh, I could, you know, write letters to my favorite American rock bands and we'd be friends and it would be wonderful. And then she stopped them and said, okay, now what are the obstacles that you have before that you're going to have to overcome to achieve that wonderful outcome? And when kids anticipated not just the great things, but the obstacles, those kids on average got grades with an A. The kids who had just fantasized about how great things would be, they were getting C's. And she says that anticipating the obstacle helps you then include the obstacle in the goal. I'm going to play less video games so I can learn English and talk to my favorite rock star.
That is so interesting. Let's get another call. Mary in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. So glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question is, you know, with the news the past couple of days about how the stock market is getting better and better, and yet there are fewer and fewer jobs for Americans. And I was just wondering if your panelists had any idea into the future how corporations are going to be using this information to decide who gets hired and who doesn't. I mean, I can imagine a time, it's kind of like, you know, 21st century eugenics, like you go to your job interview and they say, oh, excuse me, could I just have a cheek swab to see whether you're a warrior or a warrior?
The old cheek swab. Mary, thank you. Poe, would you take that?
Well, it's conceivable. You know, we mentioned earlier in the show the length of the ring finger versus the index finger and how that's associated with entrepreneurship and growth. And, yeah, you could have a scenario where a venture capitalist says, I don't want to see your business plan. I want to see the palm of your right hand to know that this is a marker. Just to be clear here, and there could be psychological tests, whether someone has a playing to win or playing not to lose mindset in their genes. All of the scholars, everything, you know, they all say that the biological determinants of competitiveness taken together at most is 50% of the equation. And the other 50% is what you do with it, how you raise your kids, what experiences you have, what habits you build up day to day every time as you're trying to achieve your goals and succeed in life. And without that element, no one is going to be successful. You couldn't just be biologically predisposed with the long ring finger to be a risk taker and just thrown onto Wall Street. It's not going to work that way. And I think in every situation, what corporations need to do is focus on correctly training their employees rather than just selecting them on the basis in any eugenical way.
So I read your last book, Poe. I've read several of yours. As I was reading this book, throughout it, I thought, gosh, are they worriers or are they warriors? So I'm going to ask you each, Ashley, are you a worrier or are you a warrior?
Well, I worry about being a warrior, so that probably answers the question. I think I'm probably, I'm one of the people who probably has both. I think that, you know, I definitely get stressed out about things and it hits me hard, but I also really like challenges and they don't throw me. So I'm probably a bit of both.
Poe, what about you?
Yeah, I think she's a warrior, but in a good way, which is that every day she's motivated and on a daily basis her brain works wonderfully. I am definitely a warrior, and that's great when I'm under stress. I mean, I actually really like the stress. It makes my brain work best. I feel clear-headed when in a very stressful situations. My challenge is that on a day-to-day basis, I don't take it as seriously. I kind of sleepwalk through class when I was a student. On a day-to-day basis, when Ashley calls me bright at 9 o'clock from Los Angeles every morning, where I am in San Francisco, I would rather she was waiting till 10 o'clock. You know, I'm like a little bit lackadaisical on a day-to-day basis.
And so your final message to all of us, after all this research that you've studied for all these many months and years, your final message based on this book is, Poe?
Is that we are – there's not one way to be competitive. We each have all these hidden factors that tease out for each of us how we optimally are suited and how to find our own strength that way. And if you enjoy reading the book, to learn about everybody's different competitive style.
Well, it is a terrific read. I wanted it to go on and on. Poe Bronson, Ashley Merriman, congratulations on this new work. The book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Many thanks to you for what you've given us today. Appreciate it very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go out on I'm the Greatest from R. Kelly from the soundtrack to the 2001 film Ali, in which Will Smith played Muhammad Ali. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When my back's against the wall, I could feel
I'm the world's greatest.
I saw the light
and that star up in the sky.
I turned on
that mountain peak,
the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
I'm the world's greatest.
Now I can just walk.
I'm the world's greatest.
It's the greatest.
It's the greatest.
Can you feel?